At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Blood alone moves the wheels of history.
They want to steal your liberty, your freedom.
I say to you, and you will understand that it is a privilege to fight.
They want to control what you see and think and believe so that they can control how you live.
We are warriors.
Don't let them step on you. Don't let them destroy your families, your lives, and your future.
Salesmen of Northeastern Pennsylvania, I ask you once more, rise and be worthy of this historical hour.
That beacon shined bright once again for the world to see. You have the ability to choose your life and determine your destiny.
We must never cede control of the motherland.
Leaders and fighters for freedom and liberty and the American dream. The best is yet to come.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. I'm Michael Steele. What you just heard was a little bit of a clip from the RNC convention with Kimberly Guilfoyle, the girlfriend of Donald Trump Jr. We'll talk about that later. Anyway, this has been an exciting time, a great week. Another national convention underway, this time by the Republicans. And it really is kind of putting on the stage for everybody to see exactly what Republicanism and conservatism is not. And we want to get into that because a buddy of mine has written, I think, one hell of a book. And it's timely and it's appropriate. And as we were just laughing, he's still trying to figure out who's going to read it. But so we're going to help today with that effort as we have a great conversation with Rick Tyler. Rick is co-founder of Foundry Strategies, a political, strategic, and communications consulting firm, and was a senior member of Senator Ted Cruz's 2016 campaign for the presidency. In 2012, in that cycle, Rick served as senior advisor and spokesman for Winning Our Future, a pro-Newt Gingrich for President Super PAC. And prior to joining the PAC, Rick was a key member of former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich's team for more than a decade, serving as Gingrich's advisor and spokesman. He is also a political analyst and a colleague of mine over at MSNBC. And his book, which I think is not only timely, but definitely appropriate, is entitled Still Right, an immigrant-loving, hybrid-driving, composting American makes the case for conservatism. Rick, welcome back to the podcast, baby.
You know, I had to change my bio because the publisher sent me and said, the leading conservative on MSNBC. I said, Michael, still not going to like that. You got to change that. You got to change it to a leading conservative on MSNBC. And I would say, Michael, there are more conservatives on MSNBC than there ever were on Fox.
I would agree. And that gets in the heart of this book. I mean, right out of the top. Look, Rick, let me just give you a snapshot. I had the privilege of doing a blurb for this, and this was my blurb, which, okay.
Thank you for that.
Self-interest here. I'm going to read what I wrote.
It's on the cover. It's on the back.
Right, exactly.
And what you know, you see who it's adjacent to, right?
Donna Brazile.
Who was the chairman of Europe. Come on now. Give me some props here. The former RNC chairman and the former DNC chairman both endorsed my book.
Now, what does that tell you, America?
That's pretty good, right?
That's pretty good. I like that. So my blurb was, quote, the Republican Party has become anti-conservative. Still Right exposes this truth by reminding us it's not about saving the Republican Party, but more about clarifying what conservatism is and isn't. Rick Tyler offers a raw and incisive examination of why conservatism matters and why it remains an important governing philosophy for those of us who are still right. And this week, you know, I've had to go through a little bit of noise about standing my ground on principle and making it very clear that Donald Trump was not the man, principled or otherwise, who is fit to leave the country over the next 4 years. How does your book set the stage for not only where we've come from in the party, Rick, but where we could potentially be going?
Well, I wanted to set a, marker for two different groups of people. One is, I believe, as you do, conservatism is a rational, in fact, an attractive governing philosophy. And that's not the way it gets portrayed in the media. And the left kind of makes it into some sort of demonic philosophy of greed. And you've heard all the other pejoratives about it. To be fair, the right does that to progressives. And I would just say, okay, I'm willing to throw out, you know, an olive branch and say, progressivism is not my philosophy, but it is a rational philosophy. And many governments are run on progressive ideas around the world. I wanted to lay down the market for conservatism, both for the left, who doesn't understand what it is. And I've had a lot of people say on the left who've read the book and said, I just didn't know what it was. I couldn't understand what the coherent philosophy was. And thank you for writing it. I understand it. But the other group I wanted to address were people who call themselves conservative and yet adopt or support every non-conservative policy that seems to be uttered from the president's mouth. This is not an anti-Trump book. It's not about Trump. It's about a philosophy, about a governing philosophy, and how conservatives think about public policy and how a self-governing people should rule themselves.
It's interesting you said that about you know, how folks are approaching it. Donna Brazile in her blurb said, Rick Tyler has written a remarkable book that describes how the GOP threw overboard the conservatism of Reagan and John McCain. To read his crisp, lucid, straightforward book is to rediscover what made the Republican Party great and why it's in need of a rebirth of principles. And that, for me, really kind of gets to the heart of it. We're talking about a rebirth of principles, a rediscovery, if you will. If nothing else, Rick, I would say Trump has exposed the fault lines that have emerged in our party since Reagan, where we began this incessant search of who would be the next Reagan. And my fear now is folks will be in search of the next Trump, which is the last thing we need after Trump is done. So that's why what you've written, in my estimation, not only makes sense, but helps kind of put up some of those guideposts to the point you were just making. How do you not just in the book describe it, but it's, how do you express it to people? You're talking to, you know, Democrats. I didn't know. It never seemed to me to mean to me what you describe. How do you tell people what it means to be a conservative to you? And how do you shape those values around that idea?
Well, I think of conservatism and its history, and you can read all about its history, but it's basically ordered liberty. And if you take out the ordered, you have, you know, really the Libertarian Party, and then that begins to border on anarchy. And so I want liberty, but I would like it orderly. Right. And conservatism is not about not embracing new ideas. It's about testing new ideas against the established ideas, and not just throwing out the old because of the new, but testing the new against the old to see what works better. And underlying all that is the ability what's written on our birth certificate: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the reason I think Jefferson wrote them in that order is because liberty is of precious little use to people who are dead, and the pursuit can only occur when there is liberty. And so then I go through different issues in the book, and I start with trade, and people say, trade, why is that important? Well, I think it's really important, and I'll tell you why. Because at the heart of the human experience is the ability to create, that we are made to create. We're a creative people. It is our creativity that creates prosperity and wealth. And we've stumbled upon this formula here in the United States that has created the most prosperous society without competitor since 1880s. Trump likes to say this is the greatest economy in the world, and on this he's right. Except every president could claim that since Warren Harding, and that until the when we seceded the British in the world's greatest economy, we have been, even under Herbert Hoover in the Depression, we were still the world's greatest.
Exactly.
We were still the world's greatest economy. And when someone creates something, and when we say creative, people often think of music and art and poetry and things like that. And those are creative, but other things that are creative are creating the world's largest retail distribution system in the world, which is Amazon.com, which wasn't always supposed to be successful. I mean, it was a long haul to get there. It means Apple and Apple products. It means all kinds of, but why should the government interfere with the purchasing decisions of Americans? I'll give you a couple of examples. One is the Chorus Agreement, which was the trade agreement that Trump updated with South Korea. There was nothing meaningful really done in the Chorus Agreement, except he claimed it was the greatest trade agreement up until that point. So I examined the Chorus Agreement, and what I found was the one significant thing that in the Chorus Agreement is Americans are not allowed to buy South Korean pickup trucks until 2032. And I thought to myself, well, what if I wanted to buy a South Korean pickup? Why should I not be allowed?
2032.
Why should I not be allowed to buy a South Korean? Maybe the South Korean pickup truck is the pickup truck that I've always wanted.
Right.
But my government said, no, you can't have the South Korean pickup truck. You know, you have to stick with these other trucks. Or take the other side of that. Take the other part of that. Barack Obama bailed out GM, right?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's, a lot of people said, oh, that's a good thing. You know, and he even made money on it. That's not the point. The point is he took my money and your money and gave it to GM. And you and I didn't get a car in return. We don't drive GM products. We didn't even get a door handle. We didn't even get get the GM emblem. We got nothing, right? We just lost our money. But it's worse than that, Michael, because when you give one company money over its competitors, then the company that's actually innovating and designing a car that I actually might want to buy is being denied. And so, you know, and then they said, well, we've got to save the Lordsville plant. Well, guess what? The Lordsville plant is now gone. It wasn't saved. And you know why it was not saved? It wasn't because of unfair trade practices or labor laws. It was because of one thing. Americans, they didn't buy the Chevy Cruze. Now, if they had just bought the Chevy Cruze, the Lordsville plant would be up and running. They didn't buy the Chevy Cruze. The plant shut down. That's just the nature of free markets.
Yeah, and that's part of the argument that we've made constantly or consistently up until this era, where we've made the case that, you know, you have the ability to create that market by what your choices are. You can decide, like you said, I want the Chevy Cruze, or you can decide I want the South Korean pickup truck. And
you can't have it. It's illegal.
Huh?
You can't have it. It's illegal.
Right. Well, that's my point. So you run into this double-edged play in which you decide, I don't want the Chevy Cruze, the plant closed down. That's the market. But then you have this artificial environment where the government has said, oh, no, I'm sorry. You don't get to play freely here because we've already set the rules a certain way. And at some point later on that we've determined, you can then get to play. That's inconsistent with what we have always argued when we talk about free markets. I've always found it interesting how the free market argument by these new Republican conservatives, or affectionately known as Trump folks, how they started making we want the fair market. We want a fair market. And, you know, fairness is in the eye of the beholder. You know, I think it's fair to step on your nuts. You may not. You may not find that a fair, you know, relationship if I'm constantly, you know, cracking you in the groin. So that's, you know, when you start getting into the space where you're trying to create fairness, and this is one of the issues I often have with a lot of my liberal friends, is who gets to decide that? I mean, unless we generally as a community come around the consensus of that, okay, that's one thing. But then when you start putting that power in the hand of the government, through policies and regulations and so forth, it gets a little bit murky. And it's interesting to have watched Republicans move off of that into this new space, talking about, you know, well, they think in this instance that South Korean deal is a fair deal. They think it's fair to the U.S. consumer, but actually it isn't, because as you just described, you've just cut off those consumers who want that product.
And that side doesn't get talked enough about, Michael, is the consumer side of it. Since globalization, which has taken on a dirty word, and Walmart and Target and all its competitors, those discount stores have done more to improve the quality of life of poor people far beyond government mm-hmm. programs. Because if you think about it, you know, the rich, you know, they may sit in first class, they may have more square footage, they may drive better cars, and they drink better vintages. But all of those things are within the reach of most Americans today. They may not have a 4K TV that's 76 inches like you have, I'm sure, but they have the 42-inch 1080 TV, which is perfectly adequate. And the free market is just that. It's free. It's voluntary. Nobody tells you have to give your dollars to any particular company.
Right.
You do it because you want what – it's a blessing. I'm blessing you with my dollars. You're blessing me with your service or your product, and it's an exchange, and everybody's happy. And as long as there's information, people can make consumer choices. And I make that case not just in free trade, but I also make that case for healthcare, because we right. don't have free market in healthcare. We have right. an amalgamation. But in trade, the Smoot-Hawley Act, which was done, I think, in the 30s,
I mean,
it was thousands and thousands of pages of all protectionism. And they even they put tariffs on worm gut. And you know what worm gut is? Worm gut, it makes like fishing nets and things like that.
Oh, but, yeah, you know, yeah.
We had to get down to the worm, the offending worm gut. He had to be tariffed. But here's the thing. Donald Trump says, you know, we're making it fair, and the Chinese are paying billions of dollars in tariffs to the Treasury. Well, no, they're not. There's no mechanism for the U.S. Treasury to tax Chinese. There's no yuan going into the U.S. Treasury. And so people understand, and I've had a lot of people say, I didn't know how this worked. Well, here's how it works. When you buy something and you import it, it goes to a customs dock, either in an airport or a shipping terminal. And the customs agent seizes your purchase, and they will release it as soon as you pay the tariffs on it. Now, who do you think pays those tariffs? It wasn't the Chinese.
Right.
Effectively, two people can pay for it. The company can pay for it, and then the shareholders get stuck with it, and it devalues the stock. Or everything that's built into the manufacturing process, including taxes, all reflect in the final retail prices, which is what you pay. And so the consumers ultimately, because it's generally not sustainable to hide costs and not pass them on to the consumer, they are ultimately going to pay the cost. So Donald Trump has imposed what is effectively a consumer sales tax on hundreds and hundreds of products that people, Americans, mostly poor Americans. Like if you put a 25% tariff on potatoes, right? Well, Bill Gates is not going to worry about the 25% tariff on potatoes.
Right.
His sous chef who's shopping today is not even going to notice it. Right.
Right.
But you know what? For the single mom, that's like eating tonight or not eating tonight.
Yeah.
Right. It's a big, huge deal. And the worst part, this never gets explained, is when you take that money out of the free market and put it in the government, see, government can't create wealth. It can only move money from one place to another. And wealth creation, I explain this way. Wealth creation is simply adding value to a product or a raw material that you possess. So if I went to your house and dumped a truckload of sand, in your driveway, you'd probably be pretty mad at me. And you'd probably say, this is pretty worthless. Get this out of here. But that truckload of sand goes to make silicon chips. Those silicon chips are in the phones that you and I are using today to make transistors. And through that, billions of transactions create trillions of dollars of economic revenue by the free market of little individuals making free market voluntary decisions to buy things, which has led to an explosion of economic activity. All from what? Sand.
Man, and right. Which I've now had chucked to my move to my garage so I can start with my workbench is burning it down.
Right. So
and you don't get any of that product.
people understand the principles of free market. And I talk about, you know, in investing. And one of the things we don't do, we talk a lot about access to opportunity, and we don't have that. And I've had a blind spot about this in America today. People do not have equal access to opportunity in healthcare. They don't have it in education. They don't have it in the networks that they have. But the other thing, Michael, we don't teach is prosperity. How do we personally be prosperous? Well, Dave Ramsey, you know Dave Ramsey. Mm-hmm. He is a top 10 radio show, and he tried to sell his show to lots of people, and no one wanted to buy it. So lucky for Dave, no one wanted to buy it. Now it's a 100% lock, stock, and barrel his. And you know what he does? He just teaches people how to manage your money, how to get out of debt, how to not be a slave to debt, and how to invest. And then I get people say, well, I can't invest. I don't have any money. There's no way I can invest. And I always ask them the same question. Do you go to Starbucks? And they say, 90% of the time, they say, yeah. You think you can give up one latte a day, just one less latte a day? Maybe. Well, if you could, that's $1,800 a year. You could put into a savings account, and year over year, you start to invest that money, and you'd be talking some real money. You'll learn the power of the dollar working for you. You don't have to put any labor into it. You don't got to go to a coal mine. Right. You don't have to go to a strawberry field. You don't have to swing a hammer against, you know, a framing hammer. You get to have money just work for you. That's what we need to teach people.
Yeah. And then that is the philosophical, you know, sort of foundation for the policies that, you know, conservatives and Republicans have advocated over the years. How does all of that translate into other things that are a little bit more ephemeral? We can nail down a healthcare argument. We can nail down a free trade argument. But what about what we see happening right now fundamentally with the Constitution, with the president's declaration that the Second Amendment gives him absolute authority to do whatever he wants to do, with the idea that the various other organs in the relationship between the judiciary and the legislative, we call it affectionately, this balance between the various players here. How is that changed now? How is that changing? How has it been changed by Trump in light of what we used to profess versus what we're professing now?
I think I have a different perspective on this. I've always liked to look at history, as I know you do, and you look at the different times when the Constitution has been tested. The Declaration of Independence reads, all men are created equal. Today, we would probably say all human beings are created equal, right? Right. And we created a Constitution, and we put out Article 1, which had to do with the legislature. They were supposed to have the most power. Article 2, which you mentioned, has to do with the executive
branch.
Article
2, yeah. I said second.
And Article 3 is the courts. And Donald Trump has really tested the power of the Article II. And I view it as this grand experiment. You know, like the founders left it this way, this checks and balances between the three branches of the government. The problem with the Congress, I think, and I'm really disappointed in my former fellow Republicans, because they have been so weak-kneed in face of all this. You know, they're the ones who are always holding up the Constitution and claiming they represent the Constitution, and they're letting Trump run roughshod over the Constitution. But you know what? I think the American people will check the president, and ultimately that is the ultimate check on the Constitution. But the Congress really needs to step up and take back its powers. And when he says things like, I can do what I want, or I can, you know, declare, you know, he's not said he'd declare martial law, but he's alluded to it. I'm not even sure the president can declare martial law. It's actually not in the Constitution.
Right,
There's some pretty court language about martial law. Governors can declare martial law. But I just don't think we're going in that direction. I think it's going to be as simple as people have a stark choice to make on November 3rd, and that is, do you want four more years of this? And I think a relative minority do. That minority thinks that owning the libs is somehow a governing philosophy. It's not a governing philosophy. And So we're going to have this huge argument, Michael, after I think Trump loses, and you and I are going to be on one side of it. And I hope the book helps.
Yeah.
But we may lose the argument because we're way outnumbered. You and I could name maybe 2 or 3 dozen people that we know personally who have a platform to talk about the principles of republicanism. Mm-hmm. That would be a minimum standard. And then conservatism as a guiding force for Republicans. And they're going to say, Michael, if you had just been with Donald Trump, been a team player, he wouldn't have lost it. Our Republican Party wouldn't have been destroyed. And we're, of course, going to say, well, you nominated a snake oil salesman and a con man to be your nominee, and he won, and he destroyed the Republican Party. And I don't know who's going to win that argument. I suspect we may not.
We may not. But so here's I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, when I made the choice to join with the Lincoln Project to take a stand because I came to this confrontation with myself over, you know, how much longer can I try to hold together something that doesn't want to be held together? How much longer can I hold a party together that clearly doesn't want to be held together? And then that got me thinking, well, why don't they want to be held together? Because more and more of its leadership and more of its members, to your point, kind of like being punked by the snake oil salesman. Mm-hmm. They it makes them feel good. They get a rush from it for whatever reasons, however they describe it, they're getting a rush from it. And it got me thinking historically, and I read Ann Applebaum's piece in The Atlantic about there will be an accounting for the complicit. And in it, she talks about collaborators, and it went off like a light bulb. I went, whoa, okay, I get it now. This is not, this dynamic to everything you're saying and everything you've just described, it's this shift. We've seen it, and we've seen it in Germany. We've seen it in Italy. We've seen it in Venezuela. We've seen it, and now right here at home, where leadership sort of begins this collaboration with the devil. And they start making these bargains because they want to get some benefit out of it. They think it somehow is going to work better. And that, like we heard when the leadership decided, okay, yeah, we can control Donald Trump. That's Dr. Frankenstein realized that ish wasn't going to work, right? So that's where we are. And then I concluded, I went, why do I feel on the defensive?
Right.
Why? Wait a minute. Hold time out. Why the hell am I feeling like I'm backed up in a corner on stuff that I've been believing in for 40 years?
Right. You and I haven't changed.
Have not changed one bit, Rick.
And not on an issue. Not on nothing.
Nothing. I mean, you just laid out in two subject areas, those founding ideals, and you know that sort of drive us, and the arguments that we've made over the years. Up through policy and principle. And I'm saying, well, why am I feeling so defensive about this? And I realized that's the sucker. That's the sucker play. The goal is to make you feel like you're the outsider. And I'm like, wait a minute, time out. Collaborators are the one who have to do the explaining, not the resistors.
That's right.
If I'm resisting what you are doing, I don't need to tell you why I'm resisting. It's rather obvious. You have to tell me why you step off those principles, why you step off those ideals, and why you decide to follow a snake oil salesman that you know is not conservative nor Republican.
Nor reliable, nor knowledgeable, nor a good defender of the Constitution, nor the rule of law. I mean, think about all the things you heard in the convention, all the terrible things that are going to happen when Biden becomes president. They're happening now.
That's the bitch slap. That's the ruse. You know, it's like you know what it reminds me of? It just reminds you get into a fight with someone and they sucker punch you and you're like, what the hell? And it's like, I didn't touch you. What are you talking? I didn't do it. It's like, no, you just hit me. No, right, I didn't hit you. And at some point you give in to that. And it's unfortunate that the party gave in so quickly. Because you would have thought that foundation had been laid over 60, 70, 100 years.
And that we won the argument with Reagan. Like we could win with a smile on our face.
Yes.
What was so hard about this?
What is so hard about it? And now they're nasty, they're mean, they're arrogant, they're ugly, and they look just like Trump. That's what it is. They look just like him, they sound like him. And then they think, and this is the sweet part, Rick. This is the part that I think is so delicious in all of this. They actually believe that when Trump loses, they'll be able to turn around on a dime and look at the American people and go, no, we were just kidding. No, yeah. No, that was, no. That's a joke. No, that's like the guy who goes to the party on Friday and he just shows his ass and he gets drunk and he's out there saying all this stuff and doing all this stuff. And then realize on Monday, he got to go to work and all his colleagues are there and he goes up and he's at the waterfront. No, man, I don't know. That wasn't me. I don't understand. No, that was you. You don't get to walk away that cleanly.
Yeah, we remember you.
They'll remember you.
But that's, you know, that's just going to be the big argument. I'm hearing echoes of it already. There's already finger pointing because they believe it. I believe that, you know, Trump's in real trouble. He doesn't have a governing philosophy, and that has finally exposed itself. You know, in 2016, there were a lot. Because I worked on a campaign, I had access to opposition research, and I knew that Trump was a scoundrel and a cheat right. and a philanderer. I mean, there wasn't a mystery to me. And I explained to the country what would happen if he got elected, because people don't change. I always quote Joe Walsh, you know, everybody's so different. I haven't changed. Now, like where did these people? I thought they were down with me. I thought they understood all that, but they don't. And they felt, see, the thing is that they just want to win. They want to win. They want to win at any cost.
Right.
And I love winning. I've worked really hard with a lot of candidates to win. Right. And, but now I'm asking, what do I get when I win?
Right. Well, and that matters.
You know, I'm not getting what I win. I'm getting more debt, more deficit, more taxes on consumer products, less free trade, a backwards immigration system, our party's getting labeled as racist, as xenophobes. I mean, it couldn't be any worse. And we knew that Donald Trump he wasn't a very particularly successful businessman. He has no managerial skills and he has zero leadership skills. And that is what has led our country down this path. And his biggest offense really is that he couldn't handle a national public health crisis when it came. And that national public health crisis in relief is stark.
Yes.
Because I was just doing the numbers because I flubbed them up so badly on Morning Joe the other day.
That was actually kind of funny. When you kept emphasizing trillion, I was like, there's a lot of people. That's a lot of people.
There are no trillion people. Well, so I've reduced it down to, you know, we have four times the number of infections that Europe has, and we have twice the number of deaths. We are ninth in the death rate of all the world. There are over 200 countries. We're ninth, and we're 10th in the overall infection rate. I mean, it's not good. It's really bad. And if you look at Asia, we have almost 20 times the death rate that Asia has. And by any metric, it's all in the numbers. It's just been a colossal failure. But it's been worse than that because of it. I was going to say we don't have basketball or baseball. We don't have those now for other reasons. But there'll be no crying in baseball because there is no baseball.
There is no baseball.
We don't have weddings. We don't have people going to school. We can't have people worship in person. We have, you know, limited access to our family, all because of this mismanagement, because the rest of the world is returning to normal. We are not normal, although we're acting normal, which is keeping the virus going. And then the president just obfuscates, lies about it, gives people bad information that compromises their health.
It's like what we just saw with the CDC. The CDC puts out new regs that Dr. Fauci, that they
the leading epidemiologist in the world.
Yeah, right. The man's under the knife in surgery. So they say, hey, let's put these revised, you know, regs out on testing. And of course, Dr. Fauci is like, well, I didn't sign off on that. I don't know. In which they're now, you know, claiming, oh, well, we don't have to do, you know, you don't have to do as much testing. You have to do that. It's the mixed messages, the sort of grab bag to try to, you know, reposition his argument as you know, against what you just laid out as the indictment of his administration and their handling, so as to position himself for a win in November. But my view of it is, it was summed up at the Democratic convention by the young woman who was talking about her father, and who said, "The only, you know, my dad died from coronavirus, and the reason basically was is that he did so because he followed Donald Trump. He listened to what Trump was telling him, and yeah, it got him killed." And so you have a lot of Americans in that position now, where they can't even rely on the information from the government to figure out what choices they should be making regarding their own health and how they protect themselves and their families. And then not taking responsibility for that is the part that for me is more galling than anything else. When you look at 180,000 dead and your response is, well, it is what it is.
Well, worse than that, you know, I just saw a poll recently, Michael, and I think it was, I can't remember what it was. It was they polled the Democrats and they polled the Republicans. Is 180,000 deaths an acceptable number? And the Democrats overwhelmingly said no. It was like 80 something, close right to 90%. And the Democrats, it was, and the Republicans, it was like less than 20%.
All right.
Now, can you tell me who the pro-life party is here? I mean, how can you be a pro-life party and think 180 deaths is anywhere near acceptable? How can you be a pro-life party and turn the other way when black men are getting killed in the streets? How can you be a pro-life party and at the border and send a woman who's seeking asylum back to her death? How can you be a pro-life party and separate a child from her mother at the border? How can you be a pro-life party when you would want to deny pre-existing conditions as a requisite of health coverage? These are not pro-life positions. These are anti-life positions.
And we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll have a little bit more with the man who wrote the book, Still Right, Rick Tyler. We'll be right back right after this.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
All right, everybody, we are back and we're talking with Rick Tyler. He is the author of the new book, Still Right, An Immigrant-Loving, Hybrid-Driving, Composting American Makes the Case for Conservatism. Rick, I want to get a little bit more into the nitty-gritty of the politics. You referenced a little bit earlier in our conversation about this fall's election. First off, give me your assessment of where you see or how you see this narrative around the vote by mail effort of this president to discourage everybody from to vote by mail. How is that impacting the run up to the election in your estimation? And how do you see it playing out? Do you think at some point, even though the run up may be one way, that voters may make a separate decision, a different decision, and still decide to play? Or how do you see all of this kind of coming together?
Well, you know, the president has said yesterday that, oh, I didn't mean the post office, you know, because you got yes, all the polling numbers about the post office, right? No. The post office, great. It's the election officials now. So it's all the election officials.
Right.
Here's what I want to say about the whole thing. First of all, the post office will have no trouble delivering mail-in ballots, even if we have an extraordinary amount of mail-in ballots, which we're likely to have because of the coronavirus and the additional states that have done it. It's very clear to me that, you know, there'll be less ballots than Christmas cards. So let's just put it that way. Mm-hmm. And they will handle it fine. Trump, as long as no one interferes, and they're giving the impression that they're interfering, which speaks to something that's very dangerous. And that is, if you attempts to undermine an election, undermines the confidence that people's vote counts, that's a real democracy killer. Because suddenly everything comes into question. And that's how dictators, you know, try to come to power, is they say, I'll save you from all this chaos. And what he's doing is creating chaos. And the reason he's creating chaos selfishly, because I don't think Trump is strategic enough to actually be a dictator or a tyrant, so we'll just dispense with that. He's doing it because if he loses, he needs a convenient excuse to say why he lost, or if it's close, to say why it was corrupt and to challenge the election. The problem with all that is for Republicans, because Republicans are more likely to be in closer races than they were in the last cycle.
Right.
They're more likely to lose races in their last cycle. And if you get a Democrat that's within, you know, a close shot of an incumbent Republican, you know what they're going to say? They're going to say, you know, the president might be right. He interfered with all this mail and slowed down the mail. And I think my ballots are still stuck at the post office. I'm going to challenge. So all these Republicans are going to get challenged in their races, and you're just going to have utter chaos. But here's the truth about it all. The post office will deliver the ballots fine. The election officials will count them. It may take them longer to count them, but they will count them. And here's why our system works so well, and it is so airtight. In fact, Donald Trump is suing a number of states over the mail-in ballot issue, and the Pennsylvania judge asked Trump campaign to produce evidence of, you know, that there has been systemic
fraud,
mail-in voter fraud.
Right.
You know how many cases they cited of voter fraud in their 500-page discovery? Zero cases. They couldn't find one case of mail-in voter fraud. And the reason is, if you mail in your ballot, if you're provided your ballot gets to the election official, they're going to take that ballot, they're going to match it against the address, they're going to match it against the signature, and they're going to check it off, and that person's name can't be voted again. So all this nonsense about, oh, I got 10 ballots in my house, if you just mail one, if you mail 10 in, only one of them are going to count if the signature matches. We have 200,000 plus precincts. Those are polling places where you go to vote. Those are all run by local election officials. And guess who else is there? A representative from the Republican Party and a representative from the Democratic Party, and sometimes independents, Greens, and all the rest of them. And they're all watching.
Right.
Right. So the idea that you could have systematic widespread fraud in an American national election, we only have one, that's the presidency, you could screw up a mayor's race. I'll admit that. You can do that. There's a lot of that can go on. There's no way you are going to interfere with the national election, which is why I would resist any effort to sort of nationalize a polling database or voter database or manage that.
Yeah, because that's when you get on that slippery slope.
That's when it could be interfered with, because you could change things and no one could be held accountable.
Right.
But as long as there's 200,000 precincts and all those people working in all those precincts watching every day, I trust that system implicitly.
Where do you place this race right now? I see it just because of the nature of how campaigns go.
Yeah.
The Democrats are really just coming out of the blocks. So are the Republicans. I see it right now as more 50-50 than anything else. There's still a 7 to 10%, depending on which poll you're looking at, group of voters who are undecided or haven't quite moved one way or the other. How do you assess it right now?
Before I make a prediction on the 2020 race, I have to explain the 2016 race, because it will preface my answer. And that is, people will say, they'll hear my answer about 2020, and they'll say, well, that's what you said in 2016. And they'll say the polling was all wrong in 2016. It wasn't wrong.
No.
The polling was right. The polling was right, and the pollsters ought to defend themselves, because they predicted that Hillary Clinton would win a plurality of votes, and she did, by 3 million votes. So they were right. State polling is, you know, a little less accurate depending on the state. And in a lot of states, we do poll a lot. In swing states, we poll a lot. We're good at it. We know what the logarithms are. We know what the expected turnout. You need all that information going in. We didn't have that in Wisconsin. The Hillary campaign clearly didn't have that in Wisconsin. And they ignored Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. But here's the other problem. And it ties into what you and I were saying about who's going to take the blame for Trump later. Because I'm sure you've already been accused. I've already been accused of, well, you elected all these Republicans. What do you have to say for yourself?
And so, oh, yeah, I totally. Said,
right?
Totally been accused.
You were the chairman of the party, right? This is all your fault. And this is what I say to them. And I say, well, you know, if 70,000 voters in three states had voted the other way, or more importantly, if Barack Obama voters who voted for Trump, and there were a significant number of them, had not voted for Trump, you know, we can point the finger at them. But here's another finger I'd point. If you take the non-black or the black non-turnout in four cities, Milwaukee,
yep,
Detroit, Pittsburgh, and Philadelphia, if those people had turned out at Barack Obama levels, Donald Trump would never have been president.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of fingers to point. And I'm not pointing at, I'm just saying that there's a lot of fingers to point. And so the black vote is motivated, right? Like people say,
oh, hell yes.
Oh, when I go out there and I say, people say, I say, well, I'd send out a poll and Biden's leading by 10. Don't do that because you'll suppress the vote. And I say, you are never going to suppress this appetite. These people are hungry. Yeah,
they are hungry.
And my sending out the poll just whets their appetite. They cannot wait to go to the polls.
Because for them, the challenge is, oh, is that just at 10? Okay, we got to get that bad boy to 12 or 15. Exactly. That's exactly right.
And they can do it. So I predict that Donald Trump will lose. I think he'll lose badly. And I think he'll take the Republican Party with him. I think there'll be a wipeout of the Republican Party. And then that's when the rebuilding is going to have to occur. I think it will be a necessary wipeout ideologically, because you can't have a party whose platform believes in, yeah, whatever the man said, that's what I believe.
Yeah, I call it giving the enema. It will definitely need an enema after these 4 years, and because it's needed one for a while, to be honest. I tried my little bit, my part. You know, I get a lot of people going, well, you ushered in the Tea Party. I'm like, no, I didn't usher in the Tea Party. And to the extent that we brought, you know, we got those 69 seats, remember, Democrats took it back with 40. Not 69, which tells you that a lot of those folks had long since gone between, you know, 2011 and 2018. So the reality of it is there was a lot of churning inside the party, and there has been for a while. And I think the way you put it is exactly right. This election will begin that process, and we're going to fight it out, and we'll figure out whether or not, you know, which side you're on and which side gets to prevail. Do you see then in the course of that struggle, the creation of some form of either the RNC Republican Party becomes, you know, take the R off and put a T, or do, you know, like-minded Republicans like you and myself decide, you know what, F it, we're just going to go ahead very much as we saw the original Republicans do with the Whigs, and figure another philosophical strain. How do you see that playing out? Does this battle come to a draw? Does it really have an end point that's worth ending this crazy?
I think after the election and Trump loses, you know, his team will go and set up some alternative television network to entertain
people. And that's already underway, right?
And that'll be a thorn in the side. But the question is for rank and file Republicans. Remember, a lot of the people who infiltrated the Republican Party were not the Republicans that you and I knew, right? They were a different cat, and they decided they were going to hitch their wagon to Trump. The Republicanism had nothing to do with it. And so we're going to be left with the core of the Republican Party, and the rank and file Republicans are going to have to decide if they believe something or not. So I think Trumpism will fade, because everything that's based on a personality, right, will also fade. We see that in other places. You see that in Israeli politics. If Bibi Netanyahu leaves the stage, his party goes away. The Likud party.
Likud, yeah.
There's nothing under it. There's nothing there. And Trump Republican Party right now is just Trumpism. It doesn't have a core philosophy. It couldn't articulate a core philosophy. In fact, so much so it couldn't even put a platform together because it didn't know what it believed, and it was too hard. And so they just skipped it. So for the first time since 1860, you know, the Republican Party didn't have a platform. And the 1856 platform actually was nine planks. Six of them were civil rights planks.
Yeah.
And the Republican Party was the leader in civil rights for 100 years after that, pretty much right up until the 1964 Civil Rights Act passed by Lyndon Johnson. And as a percentage, more Republicans voted for it than Democrats. We forget about that. But it was a Democrat-led effort. A lot of Democrats voted against it, particularly in the South.
Well, yeah, because remember, the table was set differently back then.
Yeah.
You know, the Democrats owned the South, and we wanted to play there because that was the gateway to winning presidential elections. We owned the North. And that led us to the fateful compromise that, you know, Nixon came up with starting with the Goldwater defeat.
We made a terrible Faustian deal.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I like to reminisce about the Republican Party and what it used to represent, but it just doesn't, sadly, it doesn't represent that anymore. Just as the Democratic Party was the slaveholding party of the United States, and they said that freely, it purged that. I hadn't heard any apologies about it, but they clearly purged that
from their
ranks. But, you know, I think two countervailing parties are absolutely necessary to get things done. And the one single word I always emphasize about governing a free people and a constitutional republic is compromise. And neither side wants to say compromise or talk about compromise, but it's the one essential element to actually governing a free people. You have to give up something. You have to sacrifice.
How do we get there? That's an interesting point you raise, Rick. It's one of the spaces that I have been trying to understand and study a little bit on, just so I can internalize it. How do we get as a nation on one level, but certainly in our politics, in our political governance, in the yin and yang of making legislation to the point where you just put it right. You know, neither party can even say the word compromise. I mean, you mentioned it and you're DOA in the caucus. I mean, I know when I was RNC chairman, we'd have our weekly Senate meetings.
Right.
And
you're sitting
in the Senate lunch, you know, dining room, the Republican caucus dining room. And I would watch certain senators, particularly then Senator Brown from Massachusetts, who, God bless him, was this boy tried. I mean, he just, like, you know, he came from Massachusetts, so he could sell all this crap that was coming up from the South, you know, from these hardcore red state Republicans, and you know, he tried to work out something with, you know, his fellow Democrats, and they look at him like he'd have four heads. But then I talked to Democrats and heard it was the same thing in their caucus, particularly in places like the House, where, you know, if you walked across the aisle and had a conversation with, you know, a Republican,
you were the enemy.
Yeah. It's like, well, what are you talking about? What were you guys talking about? You know, what happened? Why did that happen the way, why has it happened the way it has?
I think I know the answer. A lot of people want to blame my former boss, Newt Gingrich. And I think there's a kernel of truth in that, but I don't think it's a larger truth. And I'll give you an example why. When Newt organized the Contract with America, which actually was based on Reagan had a Contract with America. People forget about that. They did a Capitol Hill Steps event. All the senators actually signed it wasn't called the Contract with America, but it was a pledge for the voter. And we forget that in 1980, the Republicans won the Senate for 2 years. They were the majority when Reagan came in. And Gingrich took that example and said, well, I'm going to do that with the House in 90, and he did that in 94. And not only the Republicans won in the House, they also won in the Senate. And the Democrats were so upset about losing power that they had to demonize. They began by demonizing my boss,
right,
Gingrich. And then Gingrich turned around and he was demonizing the Democrats. And there was a lot of, because real power was at stake. And that's really at the core of it. There's a, between Gingrich in 94 and today, the House and Senate, almost every single cycle has been at stake. And so there's real power. And that leads people to partisan divisions. But I'll cite this about Gingrich. Gingrich's first State of the Union response pick, because the speaker gets to pick it, was Christy Todd Whitman, governor of New Jersey. The mm-hmm. conservatives hated him for that mm-hmm. because she was a moderate mainstream Republican, but he wanted to send a message that we're not purging moderates out of the party. Mm-hmm. The second was some of the committees wanted to purge the pro-choice members off of the committees out of power. Not, they can't have chairmanships. And Gingrich stepped in, unusual for a speaker, you know, let the committee chairman handle it all. And he said, no, that's not going to happen. And he protected the pro-choicers.
I know he did it a lot for Connie Morella, who was at that time a Maryland congresswoman. And he would tell Connie, I just need you for that one vote for speaker.
Yep.
And then you're free to do whatever you want to do.
That's right. That's right. And so he did that. And he also gave them, remember, the Clean Water Act. The Democrats, almost immediately after Gingrich assumed power, one of the first bills that came out was a Democratic-sponsored Clean Water Act, Clean Water, Clean Air Act. Mm-hmm. And they passed it. So Gingrich knew you had to give in. You had to let the Democrats have something. Otherwise, they were just going to be a pain in the neck all the time. You got to know how to negotiate with them to keep them, you know, delivering to their constituents. Otherwise, they're just going to deliver on you. And so
right.
I think he managed that. And now here's where it really it starts to change. It changes with the, sadly, the infusion of talk radio, cable news television, and the internet, because it formulated this toxic cocktail of people who are making careers out of holding stark partisan lines.
Mm-hmm.
So you can name them. I mean, right. the Rush Limbaughs of the world, who I used to listen to quite regularly and love listening to Rush. I never heard anything like that. He was actually speaking conservative values and he was funny. And
it was entertaining, as I called him once.
He was very,
and a hell of a lot of trouble for calling him that.
He was very entertaining, but here's the problem. The problem comes when you want to get something done in Congress and you say, well, in order to do that and to get what you want, so like maybe a tax cut or maybe reciprocity on firearm licensing or, you know, just name a whole number slew
right.
of things that people want, right? You're going to have to compromise and you're going to have to give in to Democrats on something. But talk radio said, no, you're selling out. So their answer to everything was no. And they let their representative, the Republicans, have it. They don't pick on Democrats, but who cares? But when they start picking on Republicans, and so when
right.
Rush turns against one or Sean Hannity does or Mark Levin, they start turning on the Republicans because they have to compromise to get what they want. Then nothing gets done. And all you have is bickering and name calling and the fact that real power is at stake. So you combine all those things. But I think there's an opportunity now, and I hope my book makes somewhat of a dent in it, that people are just tired of that. And they want to return to a more simple time, a more normal, when people were collegial and decent to each other. And while we don't intellectually agree, that the relationship is more important. And I write about that in my book, is that I think relationships are more important in politics. There's a lot of my friends who are Trumpers, and we disagree vehemently over, but preserving the relationship is more important. If it means I can't talk to them about politics, I won't talk to them about politics, because my relationship with that person is far more important than making them believe something they don't want to believe.
Rick Tyler, the man who's written, I think, a very important book for these times, kind of lays it out, doesn't hold back, and puts it into perspective. Still right, an immigrant-loving, hybrid-driving, composting. I love this composting American part. That makes me smile. American.
Composting personally. I mean, I'm still. The worms are composting.
But the book, folks, really touches on the struggle that a lot of Republicans, conservatives, are trying to reconcile their political identities with their traditional political party and what it stands for right now. And Rick gives us some old guideposts to remember, to understand how we got here, and some new ones to get to where we need to go. I highly recommend you check it out. Rick, thanks, man, for coming on. I appreciate your time. And as always, you have won, by the way, the Zoom background for Zoom, period.
For
I
now.
Mean, it's just the garden now. Thing, it works. We love it.
<I'm> composting.
But thanks for coming on, man. It's been
a real
pleasure. And please check out the book. Follow Rick on Twitter, at Rick W. Tyler. And certainly check out the book on Amazon and all other wonderful book sites that you can get a download or buy a hard copy, because it is worth it. That does it for now, folks. We really appreciate you, everybody, checking us out. Don't forget to find me on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, wherever you get your download on. Do the download thing. I love it when you do the download thing. I do the little bumpy bump dance. It's all good. And follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. And until next time, I'll see you then.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.